Chapter 21 Dreams and Visions. There is only one way to see, and that is through the knowledge of one's own eyes, looking straight ahead. Rogel Dawn, Principles of Sound Defense. The sun came up fast. It was bright and warming. He watched it glinting off the waters of the bay. He tried to relax. The farm workers had started their toil early, wandering up the mountain slopes from the settlement below before sunrise, their scythes across their shoulders. He could hear them as he had heard them for the last 2 hours, taking their blades to the grasses that threatened to choke Sotha's black halls, laughing, chatting. He could smell the rich scent of cut stalks filling the early morning air. Gilliman sat down on the grassy promontory, the upper slope of Mount Pharos. He wiped a hand across his brow. Sotha was a good world, a peaceful place. All of the forces and influences that insisted he return to Macragge were somehow softened here in this summer light. Gilliman, to his shame, realized how much he craved this peace. Sotha was like a mythical Eden. For an irrational moment, Rabute Gilliman willed Dantioch to fail in his efforts to retune the Pharos and wished never to return. A part of him knew that he could live out his days on Sotha in utter contentment, bare-backed and tanned in the sunlight, careless, mowing the grasses with his scythe, season in and season out. It was just a dream. Such simple pastoral destinies did not lie in store for beings like Rabute Gilliman. Fate held for him a future of duty and responsibility, very different from that which might await an honest agri-worker. No common farmer would play a role in the final battle against Horus. He heard a heavy tread crunching towards him and looked up. "My lord," Sergeant Arcus said, saluting. He was carrying his company's standard. "At ease, Arcus," Gilliman told the ultramarine. Arcus's armour glinted in the sunlight. "You're trying too hard," he added. "My lord?" "When I arrived last night, your armour was in perfectly respectable condition, as was the plate of the other battle brothers in your company. I remember these things. This morning you've buffed your plate to the point of insanity." "My Primarch is here," Arcus said, offended. "A surprise inspection of this post. What else would I do?" Gilliman got up and faced him. "I'm sorry, Arcus. My remark was petty and uncalled for. Your armor code is perfect." Arcus nodded and rested the base of the standard on the ground. "My lord," he said, "I am an ultramarine. Trying too hard is the entire point of us, isn't it?" Gilliman smiled and saluted Arcus. "Make your report, brother," he said. "Warsmith Dantioch says we will be ready to test in 1 hour," Arcus said. "You can tell him I'll be there," Gilliman said. Arcus saluted and walked away. Gilliman turned his face towards the sun and tilted his head back. "Brother!" Gilliman turned and saw the lion walking down the mountain slope towards him. Behind the lion, a young scout from the 199th Aegida followed anxiously. "Brother!" Gilliman returned. The lion sat down on a boulder, tired and frustrated. He locked his hands over his knees. "Rabute," he said, "you should listen to this young neophyte. What's your name, lad?"
"Obadei, my lord," the scout said.
"Tell it to Rabute." "My pardon, tell the Primarch before you," said the lion, "what you told me." Obadei looked at Gilliman. "It's all right," Gilliman said. "Tell me, son."
"The most noble lord of the first," replied the scout, was asking me about this site, about the experience of the posting here. I may have spoken out of turn.
Then if the harm is done, said Gilliman, you can do no more harm repeating it. Speak, Obadiah. There will be no repercussions.
Well, then, about this place, Lord, Obadiah said, it is an odd place to be, an odd place to garrison for any time. The Pharos, it breeds dreams. It is alive with them. If you stay here long enough, or live here as we do, the dreams begin to permeate you. They are as much part of this mountain as the grass, rock and air.
Obadiah looked up at Gilliman.
I hope you believe me, Lord, he said.
I do.
Gilliman thought of the dreams he had just had, of renouncing his rule and living out his days in a careless pastoral idyll. The Pharos magnified things. It made truths and hopes seem very real. Just a night in its environs had given flesh to his private wishes of an end to duty and responsibility. We have begun to notice things, patterns in our dreams, Obadiah said. We have learned to pay attention. Warsmith Dantioch, may blood be his honour, has told us that the Pharos here gives light upon an empathic vibration. This would account for much. We have all felt it. My worthy sergeant, Arcus, he had a dream. He dreamed that the Dark Angels were coming to Macragg, and lo, 2 days later, this very thing happened. Captain Adalus, just 2 nights ago, had a dream of blood, and woke up calling out the name of Kurz.
Kurz? Asked Gilliman.
They saw it coming, the lion said to Gilliman.
Thanks to this lighthouse, Gilliman said.
Thanks to this lighthouse and its Xenos function, the lion agreed.
Gilliman looked to Obadiah. There is something more, isn't there? He asked.
There most certainly is, said the lion. All in my company first thought that the dream of the Dark Angels was merely a coincidence, said Obadiah. But then the dream of Kurz persuaded us there was more going on. Last night, my dear lord, I had a dream.
Share with me its contents, son, said Gilliman. Tell me of this dream you had.
Obadiah told him. Dawn was not far off, a cold and dismal dawn. Drab smoke wreathed the castrum and the high towers of the fortress, a legacy of the bloody night that was only now passing. Aircraft and ground forces from the fortress continued to make systematic sweeps of the Civitas's vast grid. Until they had found what they were looking for, there was no telling that the bloody night would become just a prequel to a bloodier day. John and Damon travelled southeast across Strako into the neighbouring deme of Anomie, moving as best they could to avoid detection by the sweep patrols. A measure of martial law had been imposed to keep civilians off the streets. They were following John's track on the damaged thoughts of Vulcan. The pre-dawn was a pale blue hour around them. The empty, stately streets of Anomie felt like they were underwater. It reminded John of his last meeting with the Farseer. Every few minutes they were obliged to take shelter in an underwalk or beneath a portico as an ultramarine search vehicle whined past overhead or clattered across a junction in front of them. Neither of them was aware of the dark shadow trailing them from roof to roof. The more John considered the Farseer's plan, the more it made him agitated. It was enervating. It was entirely the type of duty he had longed to perform for what felt like forever. It was a contradiction of the Cabal's desires, a refutation of their philosophy and their control over him. John had a chance to fight as a man on the side of mankind. It was, however, not going to be easy. John hoped he had the skill, wit, and determination to see it through. The Cabal wanted Vulcan dead, for they had foreseen the epic role he would play in the final war against Horus and the Warp. He was destined to be one of the most stalwart defenders of ancient Terra. The Cabal did not want him alive to perform that conspicuous role. Eldrad Ulthran had seen more. He had seen Vulcan's insanity, the demented state forced upon the proud Primarch by the foul Night Haunter. As it stood, Vulcan was already out of the game. He was in no state to fulfill his destiny as the Cabal had predicted it. If John took no further action, his mission would be deemed a technical success. The spear was a potent weapon. In the hands of a Primarch, it could kill anything, even an unkillable being. In the hands of a Perpetual, however. Eldrad Ulthran's proposition was that, under those circumstances, a different result might be obtained. Empowered by the touch of a Perpetual, the spear might cure instead of kill. If John could strike the blow, then perhaps Vulcan might be restored. Rather than removing Vulcan from the war, John Grammaticus could repair and empower one of the Emperor's most powerful sons and most important allies. There were obstacles to overcome. The presence of Kurs lurking somewhere in the Civitas was a significant one. The Ultramarines and authorities of Macragg were another. Vulcan himself was a problem. How did one get close enough to stab an insane, hyper-aggressive Primarch? Then there was the Cabal, of course, and the agent they had sent to be John's handler. John had known Daemon Prytanis for a long time. They'd never really been friends, but there was a lot of common ground between them. Though both Perpetuals, they were very different. John had always been very much the spy, the infiltrator, the covert operative who manipulated through disguise and dealt in information. Daemon called himself a soldier, but he was a killer, pure and simple. He was an assassin, a taker of lives, and he did this with impunity. Daemon Prytanis would not hesitate to take John's life if he thought John was reneging on his mission. Or would he? As they walked, John glanced at Prytanis, watching the easy gait, the casual demeanour, the shabby fur coat and muddy boots, the effectless manner that actually covered a hard-wired combat readiness. There was doubt in Prytanis. There was misery. Like John, Prytanis had served too long and against his own breed. John sensed in Daemon Prytanis much of the resentment that was bottled up inside his own soul. A storm eagle flew overhead, circling slowly on wickering engines, probing the lanes and back walks between Habs and Insulae with cool blue-white stablight beams. Daemon and John ducked in under an arch, waiting for it to pass on. "Can I ask you something?" said John. "Sure. How I remain so effortlessly cool while you're a hectic jangle of ticks and quirks? It's because you're a psyker, Johnny, and I'm a fighter." "Well, not that, but thanks for the assessment." John paused. Then he said, "How do you live with it?"
"With what?"
"Serving the Cabal."
Daemon shrugged. "They pay well," he said.
"I thought so too. But they're using us as weapons against our own kind," John said simply. Daemon made a face. It was an "I want you to stop talking" face, a "we've had this pointless conversation 100 times" face.
"You really are having a problem with this mission, aren't you?" Daemon asked.
"Aren't you?"
"No," Daemon replied. "Hell no."
He glanced out to see if the gunship had moved far enough away for them to get moving again. It had not. He pulled back inside the arch and scowled at John.
"I agreed to serve them," he said. "I'm a soldier. I'm loyal. End of."
"I can read that you're not," John replied. Daemon jerked back, eyes widening in alarm.
"Get out of my damn head, Grammaticus. I didn't invite you in."
John held his hands up to show no intent. "I'm not trying. Besides, you're warded against me,"
he remarked. Very clever warp magic, Damon. The Cabal's not above using anything, is it? Whatever works.
Damon leaned back against the bricks, scratched his temple, and sighed.
Look, John, if you want the truth, I am sick of it. Sick of it all. I am sick of serving those Xenos pricks. I hate the fact that humanity has to take the fall to save the cosmos. I'm like you in that. But I was also telling the truth just now. I agreed to serve. I'm a soldier. I'm loyal. They showed me the bigger picture, and I accepted it. I didn't like it, but I accepted it. They showed me the greater good. I'm a soldier, John. I understand expediency, pragmatism, and necessary evil.
We were all soldiers once, said John.
All that experience taught me was the power of comradeship.
Damon sniffed.
Yeah, fine. I've got more heart than you think I have, Grammaticus. This whole thing hurts me more than you know. Maybe I'm not a soldier then, just a killer, an assassin. That's how the Cabal has employed me these last few thousand years. I work well. I work wet. The first thing I ever killed was my own conscience. It was a mercy killing. You still have yours, Johnny, and I really pity you for that.
He grinned at John as if he had revealed some deep and profound truth.
Okay? He asked.
John smiled at the use of the archaic slang. You sound like all, he said.
That loser? Asked Damon sourly. Screw it, John. If you want to see what happens to a man when he listens to his conscience, then look at Alania's fucking person. That surly old bastard could have used his gifts for good. But where is he?
John smiled, a blank kind of, well, you have me there, look. He hoped to hell that the Cabal had not detected the risky clandestine efforts he had made to assist old person during the Kalth disaster. Moreover, he hoped that they were blind to the new course that he had set Ol Person upon. Unwillingly, Ol had embarked upon a thankless and thoroughly hazardous journey at John's bidding, to do something John knew full well that the Cabal would abhor. That was why John hadn't been able to do it himself. That's why he had recruited Ol. It seemed that they were both about to strike blows for mankind against the interests of the Cabal. This truly was an age of rebellion and revolt. Damon stared at John. He smiled, but there was very little warmth in the smile.
Let's go, Johnny. You've had your moment. I get that you don't like this anymore. Sorry, that's tough. Boo-hoo, too late, as someone recently said. We're going to do this. We're going to do it properly and square it away. We're going to complete this damn mission if it kills us.
It just might, John said.
Comes with the territory, Damon replied. I'm ready. Always have been.
What if I refuse, Damon? John asked.
The gunship had moved on. Damon stepped onto the pavement. He looked back at John.
Why would you go and do a silly thing like that? He asked cheerfully. Besides, I'm not going to let you refuse. That's why I'm here.
I wish to serve, said Fafner Bloodbroda.
You have already served, brother, Verus Caspian assured him. And served honorably.
Entering the audience hall of the residency, Fafner had bowed before the new first master of the Ultramarines out of respect. He got off his knees, and there was some effort involved. He had to lean on his axe.
Kurz left one of your pack dead and put three more in the apothecarium, said Caspian. You ought to be there too. Your service is...
We are hunters, said Fafner. Curs must be stopped. Allow the able members of my pack permission to deploy into the town, and we will find him.
For a rematch? Asked Dolor, standing at Caspian's side.
Fafner grunted.
Wolf, your valiant efforts are noted, said Caspian, but we do not even know if Curs still lives.
"Have you seen his corpse?" asked Fafner.
"No."
"Then he still lives," said the packmaster.
"I say you should allow the wolf to assist you," said Yuton. She stood to one side of the Legion commanders, her arms hugged around her, her face more pale and gaunt than ever. "The Space Wolves have displayed the most devoted and emotional loyalty to the rule of law," she said. "I owe them my life." Fafner looked at the Chamberlain Principal and nodded in appreciation. "I would, however, wish that the Packmaster saw to his wounds before he set to inflict the same upon others," she added.
"It's nothing," Fafner said.
"You leave blood wherever you walk."
"I'll allow you to hunt," said Caspian to Fafner, "but you wait an hour for our first search sweeps to be finished. Let's see what they pick up. If Kurz is still out of our sight by then, the wolves can join the hunt."
Caspian glanced over at Timur Gantulga, who was waiting nearby, fronting a group of his own battle brothers, and Eiron Cleave's Iron Hands.
"The White Scar's petition is also granted subject to similar conditions. It was astute reasoning that led you to see that Kurz had switched from the fortress to the residency. Both you and the wolves clearly have insight into his tactics."
"How reassuring should we find it that the Space Wolves and the White Scars think like Conrad Kurz?" asked Farith Redlos. Dolor looked at him sharply.
I mean to say," said Farith Redlos, "perhaps we can learn much from our more feral brothers."
"Like manners," suggested Dolor.
"My lords, Lady Yuton."
They turned to see Titus Prato limping into the hall. His face was tight with pain. Like Fafner Bloodbroder, he had not spent anything like enough time in the Apothecarian.
"I bid you all come with me quickly," he said directly.
They followed him out of the hall and along a banner-lined terrace into the reading room of the residency. The chamber was lined with glass-cased cabinets filled with books and slates.
"Look," said Prato.
An odd glow had formed in one corner of the reading room. It was distinctly an other light, the displaced luminosity that accompanied the Pharos's communication field. The curious light reflected eerily from the glass cases of the cabinets.
"I believe that Warsmith Dantioch is attempting to retune the link," Titus said.
"This is good news, at least," said Caspian.
"We must set up a watch to see if contact improves," said Prato, "and also have patrols tour the residency and the fortress. There were multiple location manifestations before stable contact was originally established."
The First Master was about to issue the instructions, but he stopped dead as the unworldly light washed over them with a brighter, flickering radiance. The field had expanded and suddenly resolved into greater clarity. A figure stood before them, half manifested like a shade of the dead walking at midnight. It was impossible to identify.
"There, I knew it could be done," a voice said from all around them. "Did I not say it could be done?"
"Who is there?" Caspian called out.
"Who hails us from faraway Sotha?"
The communication field flickered and then disappeared altogether. The odd light drained from the reading room. Caspian, Dolor, and the other Ultramarines officers looked to each other.
"I'm afraid this process could take days or weeks to establish," said Prato.
"I do not comprehend this trickery," said Farith Redlos. "But perhaps—"
"No, no, not lost,"
the voice suddenly cut in, speaking out of the cabinets, out of the very books around them.
"Not lost at all. Patience, the field must be stabilized, that is all. Just a small adjustment and—"
Silence.
"That was Dantioch's voice. I would swear it," said Dolor.
"My Lord Dantioch, Warsmith," Caspian called out again. "This is McCragg. We hear you. We almost see you." "I insist it is not lost. I will not let it be lost,"
the voice boomed and cut away. Abruptly, the light returned. This time it was brighter and more steady. Everyone stepped back involuntarily as a portion of the reading room filled with a gleaming black mirror stone of primary location alpha, as if some ingenious mechanical scenery for a play had been rolled out across a stage. The clarity of the background was astonishing. They could almost feel the cool black rock and the soft air. The immediate foreground was slightly out of focus, creating a hazy cloud in the shape of a man or some man-thing. The focus popped. The figure resolved into perfect clarity to match the background. It was the Warsmith, slumped uncomfortably upon his great wooden seat on the tuning floor. He appeared tired and haggard, propped up by his crude throne. He looked like the ancient monarch of a dying kingdom, the last of his line, waiting wearily in an abandoned throne room for his life, his rule, and his name to become history.
"There, as I said," the Warsmith announced, "not lost at all. Sensitive, but not lost."
"My Lord Dantioch," Caspian said.
"Well, I can't do anything about the sensitivity," said Dantioch. "There is still so much about the process to learn and understand."
They realized that he was not addressing them. He was speaking to one side, to a person or persons not in the field.
"My Lord Dantioch," Prato called.
The Warsmith peered out of the field at them.
"My Lord Prato," he said, "it is good to see you. Transmission was disrupted for a while."
Dantioch looked to his left.
"Move to your right," they heard him say. "The focus is here. I see Prato and others."
Other figures appeared beside him, repositioning themselves in the field. Two ultramarines, then a figure in yellow plate, unmistakably the Imperial Fist, Alexis Pollux.
"How is Pollux there?" Prato exclaimed. "How?"
His words died away. Rabute Gilliman and the Lion loomed into the field beside the seated Warsmith. Everyone in the reading room dropped to their knees.
"My friends and brothers on Macragge," said Dantioch, "do not make me attempt an explanation, for it is too complex. In short, I am happy to confirm that your Primarchs, along with the worthy Alexis Pollux, are alive and here with me on Sotha."
"The Emperor be praised," said Caspian.
"I fear the knight's losses were too great for us to bear," said Farith Redloss.
"There is the small matter of us returning," said the Lion. "We have stepped across eternity, so it seems, by simple force of will, of need. It was not a conscious decision, but rather one of the emotions."
He stepped forward, but did not seem able to pass into the reading room. Every time he came too far, he simply vanished from the field. Striding back into view, he glanced at Dantioch in frustration.
"It did not promise it was a two-way process, my lord," said the Warsmith, and sighed. "Try to focus on your greatest need, your greatest wish."
"I should make a wish," said the Lion. "You make it sound like a fairy story."
"Perhaps such technologies and their functions are the root of such stories," said Dantioch.
The Lion scowled.
"I do not wish to be here," he said.
Again he seemed to have no success in stepping out of the field. Gilliman stepped forward beside him. Just like the Lion, he too passed out of sight, unable to step across. Gilliman shook his head and smiled a sad smile, regarding his failure more stoically than had the Lion. He stared out at his officers.
"I have news," he said, "which if I cannot cross over, I must at least urgently impart to you. First, though, tell me, has Kurz been captured? Slain, even?" Not yet, my lord, said Dolor. You will update me, Gilliman replied, nodding. He must be apprehended. In the meantime, I command you at once to prepare the fleet. Visitors descend on Macragge. You must be ready to greet them.
It will be done, said Caspian.
Yuton stepped forward.
I am glad of the sight of you at least, lord, she said. Kurz told me you were dead.
Kurz told you? Gilliman asked in alarm.
Kurz almost killed our dear lady last night, my lord, Caspian explained.
Gilliman started forward, grave concern plain on his face, and took her by the hands to comfort her.
Are you well? Did he hurt you? He asked.
She smiled.
I am well now, lord, Yuton said. I am well now. Look, what did you wish for?
Gilliman looked down and realized that he had stepped across.
I did not wish for anything, he admitted, except that you were unharmed. Evidently I needed to be here to make sure of your safety.
He looked back at the lion. He had never seen his brother so stricken with frustration. Gilliman faced the field and reached out his hand.
Give me your hand, he said.
I cannot,
the lion cursed.
I need you here with me, brother, Gilliman insisted.
He leaned in, seized the lion's hand through the edge of the field, and pulled. The lion stepped through into the reading room.
How did you do that? The lion asked Gilliman.
I think, said Gilliman, that I am more open with my needs and my hopes. I do not sequester them as you do, brother. The field could not read you. In that theoretical, there is perhaps a practical that we both might heed.
The lion hesitated. Then he nodded and placed his left hand around their already clasped right hands. Behind them, Dantioc shifted painfully on his wooden throne. His latest efforts had sapped much of his strengths. He looked at Pollux.
Will you go?
Dantioc asked Pollux.
I think the field will permit me, Pollux replied, for I need to be on Terra, and Macragge is one step closer, but I fancy the mysteries of the Pharos might be more expediently uncovered if comrades work together.
Dantioc held out his hand. Pollux took it.
I will be glad of the help, Alexis, he said.
As I am already glad of yours, Pollux replied.
Pollux looked out of the field at Gilliman.
I will stay here for the while, lord, he said, with your permission. We will work to unravel further the mysteries of this light and this link.
With my blessing, said the avenging son.
Pollux saluted.
Tell me about Kurz, Gilliman asked his officers. How close are we to finding him? What other crimes has he committed? There is much to tell, said Dolor.
But first, said Yuton, you say we are to ready the fleet? For whose arrival? Who comes to Macragge of Rabute?
Another brother, said Gilliman. Another angel.